Whether we notice it or not, our lives are infused with pattern. We wear striped pajamas to bed, pour honeycomb cereal into our bowls in the morning, throw on a paisley scarf maybe to keep warm. Our next guest shares the science and the stories of how these patterns, like polka dots, camouflage, and herringbone, came to be and why we like them so much.
Jude Stewart joins us now. She writes about design and culture for Slate, The Believer, and Fast Company. Her latest book is called Patternalia, an unconventional history of polka dot stripes, plaid, camouflage, and other graphic patterns. Jude, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jude, why do you think it pays? It's important that we pay attention to the patterns that surround us in our daily lives.
Well, I'm always interested in these things that are ubiquitous, visual signs that are ubiquitous, but, you know, just go unnoticed, because once you start noticing them, you can't unsee it. So my first book was about color, and I had that feeling about color of what are all the things that red could mean, and it's kind of amazing when you fall down that rabbit hole. And I had a similar realization with patterns. You know, at one point, it just pretty much pawing through the sock drawer, I thought, how do I know the names of all these patterns, seersucker and argyle? And, you know, you can just list name after name. But then my knowledge didn't go any further. And I thought, this is just really ripe for exploration. I mean, and when I went to look for answers, there really weren't as many as I expected. So I kind of got hooked.
Well, and there's some science behind this, too. It's not just that these things have an interesting cultural history, but it sounds like our brains actually crave patterns and want to see them.
Yes, exactly. There's a gestalt concept called pregnance. So when we see disconnected, you know, stimuli out there in the world, you try and make a form out of it. There's some interesting kind of sideline kind of phenomena of that. There's a phenomena called pareidolia, which is the tendency to sort of see faces in random stimuli. So, you know, when I think about an early pattern memory that I have, we had this one bathroom that was tiled up with these little hexagons, black and white hexagons, and I used to see them as little pandas. So that would be an example of pareidolia.
And there are names for things that I never knew there were names for, like when you look at an image and maybe you see a young woman with a scarf or maybe you see the old lady, and these things have words,
have
exactly. Names.
Exactly, yes. The general term is apophenia, which is the tendency to sort of see a pattern where there may or may not be intended one. So when you're gambling and you're sort of feeling like you're on a hot streak, you're perceiving a pattern, but it may not actually be there statistically speaking, but that tendency is called apophenia.
And getting into the patterns themselves, you write that patterns kind of meet at the intersection of design and math. Can you explain what you mean by that and how they intersect?
Well, so I have a chapter at the end of the book that is called Off the Grid, and it was sort of the grab bag of all the interesting stories I found about pattern that didn't fit into some kind of obvious visual trope. And a lot of them I found were in math. So fractals had this really interesting story, and you're probably familiar with those posters from college dorm rooms of fractals. Well, it's really interesting, and the deeper that you learn about the math, the more you're kind of fascinated with the surface shape. But I really loved looking into Islamic patterning because that is sort of a perfect meld of kind of culture and math. So the goal with those patterns was to both explore mathematical concepts but to also reveal a sort of aspects of Allah. So you're trying to, in creating these patterns, you're trying to bring out certain elements of abundance or just different values of the faith, and then math is considered an equal expression of those values as a visual or, you know, a piece of text or something else. So that was pretty cool.
Since we're on radio, can you describe what some of that Islamic patterning looks like?
Well, a lot of people are familiar with the Alhambra, which is in Spain, and that's probably the most famous example of Islamic patterning, but they have these very dense, you've probably also encountered it in the form of very ornate tile work. It informs a lot of very ornate patterning of rugs. And what's interesting a lot of times is that you can't really determine where the center of the pattern is, so that comes from the feeling that Allah is invisible and he's everywhere. The center is everywhere. So it's quite fascinating and sort of mind-bending when you look at those patterns. You can't really see where they start or stop.
And to come back to something pretty ubiquitous in America, the polka dot. Now, you would think, okay, a bunch of dots. There's not a lot of backstory there, but there is. There's a ton of backstory about polka dots. Can you tell us about their beginning origin story and a little bit about how we went from there?
Yeah. Oh, I love that story. So I looked into that, and polka dots indeed do come from polka music. There was a craze in Europe and also in America in the 1840s through the 1860s for polka music, and it was all the rage to take polka lessons and, you know, buy lots of different sheet music and kind of always have a new polka at your party. And it was such a rage that a craze that merchandising was sort of a big part of it. So you could buy polka hats and polka pudding and polka curtains. I actually have the recipe for polka pudding, which maybe I could send to you and you can put it on your website. It sounds delicious. But then polka dot was another aspect of that merchandising craze. So we don't have the hats or the curtains anymore, but we do have this remnant in the name polka dot.
It's the dot. So what did the dot have to do with the dance? Just marketing?
You know, that is a good question. I mean, it's one of those where to me, the factual answer is not unimportant, but what's interesting is all the theories that people have. Some people say that the liveliness of the dots sort of mimics the two-step nature of the dance. There's other like kind of apocryphal stories that way, but you could probably add your own, I guess, Veronica.
Well, and then polka dots, they become this sort of Where's Waldo thing. You have the polka dot bikini. You have the supposed polka dot dress at the bystander at JFK's assassination. Polka dots just keep coming back, don't they?
They really do. And what was interesting to me was once I'd gotten to the bottom of why we called them polka dots, I really wanted to go wide angle with it. I thought, okay, well, had this kind of crazy thought experiment. You know, what if you could go to a magical Google search type machine and you could put in not polka dots as a keyword, but just the visual, you know, the wordless thing? What would you get back? And what would you learn about visuals that you and I would call polka dots, but other cultures would not? So that revealed this whole other side of dots. There are male initiation rituals in the Congo that are just completely covered in what we would call dots. There's Zen meditation rites involving dots. There's prison tattoos the world over that are essentially little five dots. So it revealed this whole other aspect of the dots' personality.
I want to talk about just one of those before we move on, the Enso, the Zen figure. Such a fascinating history behind just this little almost circle.
Yeah, so the idea there is that you're just drawing freehand circles as a meditation device. And Zen believers would say that that's a very expressive act, that it shows all your spiritual depth is revealed in how you would make the Enso. So if you're doing this every day, and maybe for a time, you're not going to draw just one, you might draw many, many, you would end up with, you know, pages and pages full of polka dots, which is kind of fun.
We're talking with Jude Stewart right now. She's the author of the new book, Patternalia, talking about the cultural history of patterns and how they infuse our everyday life. We're getting some of the stories behind them. Now, moving on, I want to talk a little bit about camouflage. Now, this is one, again, which is pretty ubiquitous today, especially in certain fields. How did camouflage get going?
Oh, my gosh. Camouflage is so interesting. I had no idea. So camouflage, I mean, of course, starts in the natural world with animals who camouflage themselves, but really became a big thing in the human world in World War I, which is the first big war in which aerial attack was a possibility. So actually, interestingly, it wasn't initially on the uniforms that people were wearing camouflage. It was more about hiding large targets from aerial attack. So there was a little bit of dabbling in camouflage in World War I, and it was the jury was kind of out about how successful it really was, but when World War II came around, there was just a huge doubling down on the idea of camouflage, and it spread to all the uniforms because at that point you had mass marketed uniforms. But then it became just bizarre. I mean, there was, as I say in the book, there's a story of inflatable tanks and decoy heads and entire troop movements being hidden and fake armies, and there was a magician who had a colonel's license, and he hid the entire Suez Canal for a decisive World War II victory. I mean, it just was like mind-boggling.
Right, and didn't some really famous designers not get started but end up working on some of this camouflage during World War II?
Exactly. So because they wanted to, you know, cover everything and hide all kinds of things, there were these units called camoufleurs, and the military would be recruiting people whom they might not otherwise be attracting to the military. So designers, theater set people, magicians, artists, a couple different famous people were part of the so-called Ghost Army, which was a very famous camoufleur unit. And they not only would be actually producing camouflage en masse, but they would be also teaching other people how to do it. So there was this kind of mass visual literacy campaign happening in the Army to teach yourself how to, you know, cover your face in the right way with camouflage makeup, for example.
Well, Jude, now that you've studied all of these patterns that are literally everywhere once we look and we see them, has it changed the way that you see the world?
Yeah, I would say so. It's true. When I see people, you know, wearing camouflage, I sort of immediately go to nerdily look up what the pattern is actually called. But yeah, I mean, I think it is really sort of done to me what it would, I hope, do to my readers, which is sort of awakened and informed my eye. You don't have to know this stuff, but it is so deepening of your appreciation and enriching of your sense of what's possible when you do know these things. So, so I continue to find myself sort of collecting little stories and, you know, tweeting things out. And it is a little bit like my previous book on color. It's called Roy G. Biv. It's a little endless, and I like that about it. It's very infinite.
Jude, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That was Jude Stewart. She writes about design and culture for Slate, The Believer, and Fast Company. Her latest book is called Patternalia, an Unconventional History of Polka Dots, Stripes, Plaid, Camouflage, and Other Graphic Patterns.